The Naples of England by Andy Christopher Miller. Chapter 6. One for a Jack. My mother used to say that I wasn't to go bothering Mrs. James, that we had to leave our neighbours in peace sometimes. But every time I knocked on her door, it was obvious she was pleased to see me. I always asked whether she'd like a game of beat Jack out of doors. And every time she stopped what she was doing and beckoned me into her gloomy back room, which was heavy with large and serious furniture. She always brought a plate of luxury biscuits in from the kitchen, macaroons with rice paper or chocolate digestives. She would play her hand carefully and lay down any card she had to forfeit in an unhurried fashion. One for a jack of mine, two for a queen, and so on. "Come again, Andrew. I'm always pleased to see you, my dear," she would say when I left, or something like that, definitely proving my mother wrong. I had known Mr. James too, before he died. I used to watch him over our back garden fence, a respectable and kindly spaceman in his beekeeper's apparel. "Don't get too close now," he once said. "They can get upset if there's any change to their routine." And they certainly could. It was actually something as small as a bee sting that ended up killing him one Sunday afternoon when I was 10. I was playing with some of the other kids up at the rec. Three of us were lying flat on a swing each and twisting the chain so that we would be swung round and made dizzy when we raised our feet from the ground. Because it was a Sunday, I wasn't allowed out for so long, but I had been to church that morning with my mother, so there was no Sunday school, and I knew that I could stay until 4 o'clock. That's why it was a surprise when my dad appeared at the corner before it was even 3. "It's your dad, Andy," Ricky said, and I ran to him, curious about his presence. It wasn't tea time. There were no visits planned, and I had fulfilled my religious observances. "Come on home," he said. "Right now. I want you at home." My father always walked at a furious pace, and when I sometimes accompanied him to or from his bus stop on workday lunchtimes, I enjoyed the absurdity of trying to move at such a speed. The sight of his arms and legs in such animation, me having to burst into a run to keep up and maintain our conversation. But that Sunday afternoon he was so clipped in his speech, with the sense of a coldness only one unnecessary question from me away. I walked as fast as I could behind him as he powered himself back along the pavement to our house, wondering what misdemeanour of mine had been detected. With an increasing sense of fear and desperate to confess and relieve the tension, I ran through the various arenas in which I might be at fault. School, the spelling test, my brother, my mum. But I couldn't think of anything serious enough to warrant this. Anything that could have suddenly come to light in the middle of a Sunday afternoon. Indoors, my mother looked at me but said nothing. There was no way I could get her alone to ask her what was happening, to tell her that I had done nothing wrong. "Go up to your bedroom," my father said, and as he caught me looking towards my mother, trying to demand her intervention, he seemed sharper still. "Do what you're told, right now." From my bedroom I could hear no sounds within the house. Silence and a sense of absence played about the walls, carpet and linoleum. I had seldom been punished in such a way and was unable to predict the likely duration nor what might happen next. Then, later, there were quiet voices in the street or possibly in our garden. I heard the door of a vehicle being closed, these muffled sounds coming to me through the air brick high up in my bedroom wall. I opened the door handle through the smallest of fractions, trying to avoid the sprung click of the latch echoing through the hallway like the smack of a stick on a snare drum. Pacing around the creaky floorboards that I knew could be heard from downstairs, I made a careful journey all the way to the window at the end of our L-shaped landing. There was an ambulance outside next door's gate, outside Mr. and Mrs. James's house, and the discreet conversation and businesslike movements of the two uniformed men seemed adult and thrilling. Next door's back door was ajar. I could hear my parents downstairs. I knew that I should retreat to my bedroom with care, but moved with a faster foot, taking more risks. I lay on my bed, drawn deeply into the mystery. The solemnity and the ruptured Sunday afternoon were clearly bound up with the presence of the ambulance. There was an agitation in the air. Ambulances glided through our estate only in the most serious of circumstances. But also the beginnings of happiness and relief, a growing expectation that I was not in trouble at all. When my mother came and told me that I could go back downstairs, she hurried on ahead of me, not available for my questions. In the kitchen, the electric oven was heating up. The earthenware mixing bowl was on the side, and my father was making a Victoria sponge. He excelled at these and made great play about the necessity for the oven being hot enough. My brother had been in his bedroom too, and my mother told us both that Mr. James had had an accident, that he'd been stung by one of his bees. Stings, cuts, grazes and bruises were the currency of my childhood explorations, a commonplace among the fields and brambles. The oven hummed, its loose handle buzzing as the temperature crept upwards. My father's jollity and busyness lifted any remaining gloom. The electric light was switched on, obliterating the last trace of dinginess. The oven's warmth enriched the kitchen, and the smell of the rising cake, the sense of a nourishing presence, cheered the whole room, passing on into the passage, the stairway, and even the upstairs landing. A day or two later, I was informed that Mr. James had died from a bee sting, or, more precisely, from the heart attack it had triggered. The hives that bordered our back garden were dismantled and removed by men from the council while I was at school a few days later. And, although I dreaded meeting Mrs. James across the fence straight afterwards, it felt very important to see again the spot where the colony of bees had lived, to know the exact coordinates of death. Only two rusty wires sagging between cast concrete posts separated this fundamental event from the unstoppable germination and growth within our own garden. But somehow this incident had already lost its power. One for a jack. New day had formed over the past. Two for a queen. The future was already present.